It is so good to be with you, and I'm excited to be here for one major reason. You're going to hear it as I speak tonight, but FCA played a really critical role in my life, and Coach Steckel called and said, we'd like to have you speak. I jumped at the chance because really FCA is so critical in the lives of so many young men and women in this country, and thank you for all you do to help support them. And I think it's wonderful. For me, when I hear that kind of introduction, first of all, Dr. Dobson did a great job for so many years, 33 years laying that foundation and following the Lord's heart. And I just loved a focus on the family from a distance when I was living here in Southern California. And when I hear an introduction like that, you know, the funniest thing in Christian work, what we do is we try to project perfection, don't we? You know, that we're perfect. And guess what? I am not a perfect husband, and I'm not a perfect father. Anybody in here a perfect husband or father? Just ask your wife. But in fact, though, I even bring proof. First of all, the photo of my family. Let me show you that photo. And you see Dennis the Menace? Is that up there yet? Let me know when it's there. It's there. Okay, so Jean, my wife, and Trent, the older, he's my scientist. The older one in the back, and then Troy, Dennis the Menace, is down in front. And so Gene and I, we bought this this little science experiment from Hobby Lobby, a little plug for Hobby Lobby, $14.99. But you connect these test tubes to this wire and battery, and you submerge it, and overnight it turns into the test tube collects hydrogen gas, which is what? Rocket fuel. And you light it with your boys, and it goes kaboom, and your boys say, you are the coolest dad in the world. But the next night, Gene and I went to a Christian-Jewish dialogue dinner, and I left this experiment out on the kitchen counter. And Troy left a voice message for us, which we got halfway through this Christian-Jewish dialogue dinner. And Gene and I went in the hall to listen to it. And imagine you're the parents of this phone call. We happened to record it, and I want to play it for you. This is Troy the Younger talking about his older brother.
Hi, Mommy. Jensen actually was dumb enough to get the battery I put my tongue on and the mini junk cables and actually plug it in the DVD player, and it caught smoke. But don't worry, it did not start a fire. This is Troy, and by the way, Trent did it, okay? Okay. Have I been specific enough? Okay, bye. Don't go easy on Trent.
All right, so. Is that Cain and Abel all over again? I mean, whenever I'm talking to a non-believer, let me play this from my boys. And it just proves the point that we're all sinners, aren't we? And I just think that's one of the greatest things. And I think it's one of the great opportunities in the church today is just be real. And funny things happen. You can imagine how fast Gene and I got out of that dinner. Gene was like, we got to get home right now. We got to get home. We don't know where that 15-year-old babysitter was the whole time. She wasn't in the picture at all, but it is so much fun. I want to paint a story for you tonight because you guys invest in ministry with FCA, and many years ago, as I said, FCA had such a dramatic impact in my life, and I want to share that with you because that's what you're celebrating here this weekend. And I think when you look at all the dots as I lay them out for you, I think you'll see what this organization has done in one person's life. And I hope that it motivates you to keep praying and keep supporting FCA. So for me, grew up in a dysfunctional home. Can you imagine that? Dysfunctional. Is there a perfect home anywhere? You know, somebody's got to have an uncle, right? Even if you think you have a perfect home. But for us, I was the last born of five kids. And I remember when I was walking down the hall at Focus on the Family with Don Hodel. Don Hodel came in for a couple of years off of the board to help initially with the transition at Focus with Dr. Dobson. And, you know, it was Dr. Dobson. And Don Hodel was President Reagan's Secretary of Energy and Interior. So, Don Hodel. And Don's walking down the hall with me, and Don says, you know, Dr. Dobson, the board and I, we think you're the guy to take it forward. And I went, no. And I used to pray for the poor guy coming behind Don Hodel. Gene and I used to pray. Just because, you know, wow, how are you going to do that? Jim who? Jim Daly? Who's that? But you know, the Lord really settled in my heart just the idea that He owns it all. He owns the broken pieces and those pieces that were not so broken. And for me, that settled it. And when I think about it, I'll paint the picture for you, because walking down that hall again and then getting home that night, I walked in the house coming through the garage door. Gene was doing dishes, and I said, Dr. Dobson and Don Hodel and the board, they want me to be president. And Gene, my wife goes, who would have thunk it? And is that perfect for your wife to say that? And then this is the honest truth. She said, can you take the garbage out? And I went, I don't know if I could still do that. She's, you know, I had one of the wife evil eye. Like, you know you can still do that. But being that in that dysfunctional family, being the last of five kids, I was the oops baby. Anybody oops baby? Isn't it great when you're at a party and your parents say, this is our accident? You know, they don't say that about any other child but you. This is our accident. And I just remember being introduced to so many people, so many of my mom and dad's friends that way, the accident. And I was 6 years younger than my closest sibling. They were all born 1 year apart, and then, oops. And so we're growing up right here in Southern California, Long Beach in this area, north of us here. And I can just, I remembered one night my dad was really drunk, and he came home with a hammer, and he kept threatening my mom. She wasn't there, but he was taking this hammer, pounding it through the walls, and sitting on this chair, just pounding it on the ground, thud, thud. I'm going to kill your mother when she gets home. And that was the night our whole family changed, obviously, and they arrested my dad, and my mom then kind of got us out of there, became a single-parent mom for 2 or 3 years before she remarried a man. And, you know, for me, it was just my mom became everything in my world at a young age, now that my dad was out of the picture. And I could just remember, you know, not knowing what was next, just all this uncertainty. But I did love sports, like all of us probably in this room. And sports became the thing that held my life together. You know, I played football and baseball and anything. I just play it, and I loved it. And that's kind of how my childhood went. And then my mom remarried. She remarried a guy, Hank. I nicknamed him Hank the Tank. And this guy, he was an ex-military drill sergeant. Great guy for a stepdad. This is the truth. He used to do a white glove Saturday morning test at the house in everybody's bedroom. He'd go in with a white glove, and if you didn't have all the dust up and everything put away, you got certain punishment for that. He was a jerk. I know that's not a Christian thing to say, but I still pray for Hank. That's the Christian thing to say. But, I mean, he just, you know, he loved my mom, and for that I give him great credit. So they were married a couple of years. One of the great ideas that Hank the Tank had is when I was 8 in third grade, to save money for a house, he thought, let's all live in Compton for a year. I am dead serious. So we lived on Artesia Boulevard, right behind the Compton Junior College. And that was not much fun. I think that year I saw two people killed, one guy outside my bedroom with a shotgun. I think Compton that year that we lived there was the murder capital of the country. And it was horrific. This one boy, he was probably 4 grades older than me. His name was Jack, so I called him Jack the Ripper. That was the way I coped, with nicknames for everybody. But he would chase me home because he thought I did something to some family member. I didn't know who he was. But he chased me home, he threatened me, and I was a lot thinner than him, faster. So I told my sister Kim about Jack the Ripper, and she was a wiry 15-year-old. So one day I'm running home from Jack the Ripper from Star King Elementary School, and out from a hedge I see this blur, and I turn around, it's my sister Kim, and Jack the Ripper's behind me, and she, bam, hits him right in the face, puts him right on the concrete, and stands over him like this and says, if you touch my brother again, I'm going to kill you. That's how you talk in Compton. I'm in third grade. And I'm thinking, yeah! And then I'm thinking, oh no, tomorrow I gotta tell my friends my sister beat up Jack the Ripper. It's like, that's not really good. So we lived there for a year, and then we moved to Long Beach. Fourth grade came, and my mom just started getting sick, and I thought maybe the flu or maybe a bad cold. And Hank just always told us not to go in the bedroom. He would lock the door and say, you know, you're gonna wear your mom out, so don't go back in the room. So I'd go weeks without seeing my mom, even in my own house. And I remember one day she called for me, and Hank was not home, and I went back there, and the door was a little open, and so I pushed it open. My mom, it did startle me because she looked really thin, and she said, hey, I want you to do a favor for me. Can you plant my favorite flowers? And I went, yeah, of course I can, Mom. You know what a 10-year-old's heart would be like. So I get a piece of paper and a pen, and she says, okay, my favorite flowers, she goes, they're chrysanthemums. I'm like, couldn't it be roses? I could spell K. So I went down and got chrysanthemum seeds and planted them in her flower box outside her window. And like a good boy, I watered them once when I planted them, and that was it. And that was, you know, that was the end of that. And then Hank came home, and something was odd, though, because when Hank was a gourmet chef, and that's what he did, and he'd come home and make us dinner, and we weren't a Christian family. I'd say we were CEO Christians. You know what that is? Christmas, Easter only. And we would sit at the table in this particular time, never before, and Hank would want to pray. And it was all clumsy. None of us, we weren't Christians. We did. Hank would just say something, and then he'd start convulsing and crying. And all of us would giggle because we didn't know what was going on. One day, my brother, who was 19 in the Navy, he came home, and that shocked me. And, wow, Mike, what are you doing home? Well, we'll talk about that. And in descending order of age, Mike, my brother, who was 19, called each of us into the room. So Mike called Dave, my 17-year-old brother, into the room, and he came out crying. And then he called Kim, my 16-year-old sister, into the room, and she came out crying. And then he called Dee, my 15-year-old sister, into the room, and she came out crying. And then he called my name, and I said, I'm not going in that room. I mean, I may be 9, but I'm not stupid. And I went in, and he put me on his knee, and he said, Jimmy, I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to say it. Mom is dead. And I was shocked. I mean, there was no, I didn't know it was coming. Nobody talked with me. Most of the kids didn't know what was happening. And my whole world just spun and turned upside down. I was like, Mom, what does that mean? Mom is dead. I'm not going to see her. You're not going to see her. And I can remember the funeral. Hank didn't go. He was so distraught. And he ended up selling all the furniture, and the people who bought it picked it up while we were at my mom's funeral. We get home, and there's just a few boxes in the living room. And we got home, and Hank came out of the back bedroom with his bags packed and never hugged us or anything. He just said, I can't take the pressure, so I'm moving back to San Francisco. You know, what do we do? Well, you guys will figure it out. Is that amazing? Exactly. And so that night, I mean, we just huddled in the living room, and we didn't have any blankets or anything. We just put clothes over us. My brother Mike, 2 hours after Hank left, had to go back to his ship in Long Beach, and he hugged me. And I love my brother Mike. He was a football player, played at University of Nevada, Reno, 6'5", 300-pound defensive tackle. And gave me a big hug, and it was like, Mike, don't go. And he walked out the door. And so we ended up the next day in foster care, which is one of the reasons that foster adoption is so important to me. And he was a friend of my brother's. My brother Dave had a friend, Paul Reel, and it was the Reel family. Now, the great news, this is the great news. My mom accepted the Lord the day before she died. The Hopes, our neighbors, the Hopes, letter to the Lord. You think I'm making this up? When I published this in a book, my publisher said, this can't be. Are you lying? No. The Hopes, H-O-P-E, they led my M-O-M to the Lord. They went to Long Beach Memorial and said, Jan, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? And she said, no. She was a good woman. She grew up Catholic as a young girl, But we never talked about God. There was no God in our family other than she would teach us the golden rule and teach us some of the bedrock truths. Do you know what I'm talking about? And so the hopes lead my mom to the Lord. And then 3 days later, we're at the funeral, and we're off to the real family. Now, the real family lived in Morongo Valley. Some of you know where that's at, out near Palm Springs, here in the Southern California desert. And they were on disability, and I think the Social Security check from us meant a lot to them. But we were there. They had 4 sons. The oldest, 18, married his 42-year-old cousin that year, Maggie. Thank you for that gasp, because I was only 9, and I had the same reaction. But I wasn't quite sure. It was somewhat maybe just born out of confusion. Oh, that's what you do. You marry your cousin, and the stork brings the baby. I hadn't had the talk yet, but I thought, oh, I'm not getting married. I have no cousins. Now you can see why I'm thinking, how could this guy be the head of Focus on the Family? Now you're catching why I laughed on the hallway with Don O'Dell. No. And then Gary, the 14-year-old, was dealing with homosexuality, later died of AIDS in 1983, became an activist in San Francisco. Marky was 8, I was 9. Marky just would steal my 4 headless G.I. Joes and say they were his, and I'd go to his mom and dad and say, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Real, Marky took this from me, and they'd say, not our Marky. Jimmy, you're just not fitting in with our family. Isn't that amazing? And I just got a great dose of, okay, nobody here knows reality. 6 months into this, the social worker comes out. She was a really wise woman. She was probably 25. College grad, I'm sure, just in the last couple weeks. And she sat at the table and she said, we have a problem. And I went, finally an adult that sees it. You can imagine, you know, a little boy, I'm just going, finally, someone who knows reality. And she said, well, Mr. Real said you tried to kill him. And I went, what? And she said, yeah, he said you tried to push him off a cliff. And in my 9-year-old voice, I said, but we live in Morongo Valley. There's no cliff in Morongo Valley. Not where we live. We lived in the bottom of the valley. And the social worker, I remember this, the first time I heard this word, she said, well, we've got 2 options. We can break you up. It was my brother Dave, Denise, my sister, and me. Or you can hunker down and stay here and be together. And I said, well, I like hunkering down. I remember the first time I heard the hunkered, let's hunker down. So we lived there another 6 months with Mr. Real fixated on the fact that I was trying to kill him. And there's got to be 2 or 3 of you thinking, well, did you? No. I mean, I became this wallflower child. I'd go to Morongo Valley Elementary School, and I'd go out to a sand hill in 4th grade. I literally, while Mr. Todd was teaching class, I would get up. I felt so all alone, so lonely. I would get up, walk out in the middle of 4th grade, and I'd sit on a sand hill and cry. And the school nurse, Mrs. Bandy, would come out and put her arm around me and say, it'll be okay. And I thought, just another adult that doesn't know reality. And I'd get in the school bus, and I'd be dropped off at T Circle Drive. I mean, this is like a Hollywood script. And I'd walk down T Circle Drive to the Reels house and go to bed at 6:30 and just lay. And this house was so small. It was a kind of an enclosed patio that had just like netting on it with 8 beds in a row. And that's where we slept. And then all of a sudden my bio dad showed up and said, hey, I found out mom died. I want you to think about coming back and living with me. I was like, wow, go back to live with dad. Oh, Dad, he's the alcoholic. If you're from an alcoholic family, you know what I'm talking about. Dad, which dad will I get? I remember when I was 7, he promised. He had been gone for 2 years, and he stopped by the house just to say hi, and I remember he promised to bring me a baseball mitt. That would have been my first baseball mitt. And I was like, you'll bring me a mitt? Yeah, I'll bring you a mitt. And my birthday came a few weeks later, and I walked out to the curb with my friend Ricky in Alhambra, we were living at the time, and I looked down, up and down the street. I probably went out to that curb 20 times, and he never came with the mitt. Some of you guys know what I'm talking about. And so that's where we were at. And then I moved in with my father and my dad. After a year, my sister turned 18, and there I was, 12, almost 12, and the family didn't think, the siblings didn't think I should live with my dad because he still couldn't control his drinking, and that wouldn't be healthy. And so they said to me, "Dad will never take it from us. You need to tell him." So we had this family conference, and there I'm sitting in a living room with my older siblings. A couple of them are married. Their spouses were there, and there's my father. And I said, "Dad, I don't think I should live with you anymore." And I remember he looked at me and said, "Well, why?" Nobody had prepped me for that question. That's a darn good question. And I just remember the only thing I could think of is I said, because of the way you treated Mom. Imagine your 11-year-old saying something like that, 11 and a half-year-old. And he stood up and he hugged me and he said, "I wasn't a good husband, I'm not a good father." And 3 months later, he died. And he walked out of that house. That was the last time I saw him, was that day. And I just remember getting the phone call. I was kind of numb. My brother put the phone down. I was living with my brother Dave then. He put the phone down, just looked at me and said, "Dad's dead." And I remember I was watching I Love Lucy. Isn't that odd? And I was laying on the sofa watching I Love Lucy. I looked over my shoulder to him, and I just remember saying, "Oh, that's too bad," and look back. It's like there's nothing here. Years later, there was a lot there that had to come up. So now I want to zero in on FCA. So I had a football coach, Paul Morrow, who we got him his rookie year out of Cal State Long Beach, he and his wife Joyce. And so they walk into my life. I've given you this background to connect this dot. And so I'm going out for freshman football, I was a sophomore. And everybody thought I would make a great quarterback and all this, and so I'm going for quarterback. And Paul Morrow just jumped in my face through all of two-a-days and that whole thing. And I love football. And he would grab my face mask and say, "Listen, if you don't lead this team, if you're not going to run harder than you're running and set an example, there is no way you're going to be quarterback." And I ended up playing free safety that year. Because I said, "I don't think I want to run that hard." But he was just in my face. And at the end of the season, he took about seven of us to Point Loma for a FCA football camp. And I was there. Now, you know the life I was in. Imagine that. I mean, I felt lonely. I didn't think every father figure in my life had been a liar. Let me just say it as straight as it could be. I didn't feel like I could trust anybody, especially older adult males. It's like nobody knows the truth, and people don't do what they say they're going to do. And that actually is something the Lord continues to deal with me, because I have a high degree. I want, if this is true, then be true, right? And I think it starts right there when I was a child, because Mr. Real and Hank the Tank and my alcoholic dad. And here I am, 15, Paul Morrow sponsors us to go to the Point Loma camp. And I don't know who the guy was. I wish I could tell you. It was, you know, Pastor Smith. But this guy up front says, "Have men let you down? Has your father let you down? Has your stepfather let you down?" I thought the next thing he was going to say is, "Mr. Real let you down." It's like, you think God was zeroing in on me? And he goes, "I know someone who will never let you down. That's the Lord Jesus Christ." And it was just, you know how when people say, yeah, I just, all of a sudden I was up front. That's how it was. I just, bang, I was like up at the front. After he said, "Come forward if you want a relationship with Jesus Christ." That was at Point Loma FCA camp at 15. And it changed my entire life. Now, it didn't straighten everything out for the next 7 years. I was still naughty. I mean, you got to put it, I was living with my like 19-year-old brother in high school. And I would say on Friday night, hey, after the game, I'm going to go out. He said, okay, what time you want me home? 2 or 3, should be fine. I'd say I'll try to stay out till 2 or 3. I don't know if I can even stay out that late. I mean, it was like there was no boundaries for me whatsoever. And I love my brother Dave, but man, that was pretty cool to live with him in high school. But the point of it is, and this is it, that God just took me by the scruff of the neck. I never got so far outside of his reach. And I don't believe anybody can get outside the arm reach of God, do you? And he just kept me in some kind of boundary there. I just never found myself in a bad, bad situation. But one time, and I got to share this with you, it was so funny. One time playing football, my brother Mike, of course, he played football, like I said. My brother Mike said, you know, now that I am playing quarterback, and I was throwing the ball for 300-400 yards a game, Don Bandy, yes, the husband of that third grade school nurse, Don Bandy, who played for Vince Lombardi with the Washington Redskins. Is this hilarious? So Coach Bandy became my football coach after Paul Morrow and put me in as quarterback my junior, senior year. And colleges were sending me the letters. Many of you guys in this room, you did it all the way up to the pros. But I got the letter from TCU and UNLV, and, you know, I was feeling pretty big about it. My brother Mike said, you know, now that you're a Christian, you got to kind of control your ego. And I was like, hey, quarterbacks need egos, right? And he said, no, that's actually not how it works. But I get, before this game in Big Bear, California up here, I'm worried about it because I know the Lord knows me. And I was praying and I said, Lord, if you don't want me to play college football because it'll take me in the wrong direction in life. This is the honest truth. Danny Paul, my tight end, was praying this prayer with me. I said, Lord, if you don't want me to play college ball, break a bone today, but don't let it hurt. Is that the stupidest prayer you've ever heard? It's also a very quarterback prayer, isn't it? Break a bone, but don't let it hurt. I shouldn't even share that with this group, huh? But anyway, so third quarter of this game, we were on about the 32-yard line, not that I'd ever forget, and it was second down. I call the play before on first down, we had, and this Don Bandy was a really good disciplinarian, you know, as a coach. We never had anybody ejected, and we had a guy that got punched in the pile. He got up, punched the guy back, he got ejected, and they bring in a sophomore, and the sophomore gets into the huddle. And his eyes are like pancakes. And so it's second down. And we're going to do a little out pattern on the left. And he's come in as fullback. And he says, what do I do? That's what he looks like in the huddle. What do I do? You get your butt out of here. That's what you do. Now I said, we're walking up to the line of scrimmage. And I said, well, step to my right and hit somebody inside out. Okay. So we had this on game film. Parrish Robbins is his name. So he takes the right step. He's out here. I drop straight back. I see my guy in the out. I also see these outside linebackers coming this way. And Parrish Robbins jumps out of the guy's way. Just we actually, the coaches had fun. They put disco music to boop, 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 boop. And this linebacker just blows right by Parrish. I go to throw the ball. Wham! This guy hits me in the armpit. I'm playing with a separated shoulder. They had it taped. I throw the ball, he hits me in the armpit, I go down, kabam, I'm in the huddle, and it's not painful, I just feel pressure. You guys have broken your collarbone, you know how this is? And I reach under my shoulder pad, and my collarbone snapped in two. I'm going, you guys, God has answered my prayer. So now they think I have a concussion. So they're calling timeout, and quarterback's a little loopy, and I'm just going, God has answered my prayer. God has answered my prayer. This is incredible. It doesn't hurt. I go out. Third down happens. I'm also the punter, so I come back in and punt the ball, and then I go off to the hospital, and they throw me in that little brace they put you in. But for me, it was amazing because, you know, in the scripture, talks about our Heavenly Father being Abba, Father. And when you look at it, for me, and the testimony that I bring, and it's, you know, the amazing thing is our testimonies are not ours, are they? The Lord buys them for a price, His blood. I mean, He says you've got to walk it, but He owns it, doesn't He? They're His testimonies in our lives playing out for whatever His purposes are. And the attitude issue for us, I mean, for us, we simply got to say, Lord, I trust You, and I love You no matter what my circumstances are. Regardless. And I can honestly say, I believe that. I hope you can feel that, even as that little boy. And once I came to know the Lord, I just always had that sense that God, no matter what hell comes my way today, I believe You're with me. And I'm not going to jettison my trust and my hope and my faith in You because of something that might happen to me in this life. And I hope your faith is that solid. Just yesterday, I taped a program with a 36-year-old woman and her husband. It's going to air in March. I couldn't stop grabbing the Kleenex. She's got fourth stage breast cancer. It's metastasized right through her body into her brain. The diagnosis is terminal. She has four children, 4 to 12. She was my mom. And as we sat there and started talking yesterday, talking about how she's communicating with her children and what her hopes and dreams are and how does she, as a terminally ill woman with four young kids, what does she think about? I mean, I was bawling because I could just feel the heart of a mom. And I told her about my experience, and she was bawling for me. But you know, the amazing thing is that somehow God is in all of it. I love the scripture that says, I'm close to the brokenhearted. I mean, it is, God is close to the brokenhearted. And He saves those crushed in spirit. Isn't that great? He saves those crushed in spirit. And you think about this life and all the stuff that's going on, whether it's, you know, a marriage that is not doing well, or teenagers that are just giving parents a hard time with drugs or whatever it might be. And you think of all the things that crumble in on us in this life. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that everything is tilting toward God. It's rigged. Now, you may be stubborn as a non-believer, and you're hanging on to that edge of the box of life. I'm not going down there. God just keeps tilting it up, doesn't He? Up, 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 up. Until you can't hang on. And then you fall, hopefully, into Him. And you either do that with a gracious heart or a bitter heart. And that's the difference. Your heart either it opens up or you just become bitter. So can you imagine for me looking back and seeing what God has done and thinking, I'm going to take this kid that basically He put me through almost every family type you could live in. Normal, dysfunctional family, single parent mother, stepfather, right? Foster family, single parent father, which I lived with, then sibling living relationship. Then my senior year, I lived on my own. Because I thought, I can do this better than anybody else. So at 17, I just lived on my own. But then to say, Lord, man, what, you know, to do that, to say, okay, I'm going to take this kid who went to an FCA camp and put his trust in me and let him grow up and then eventually become the president of Focus on the Family. It's mind-boggling. And I still don't get it. I treasure it every day. But most of all, when I look back at it, I want to thank from the bottom of my heart, that fourth grader heart crying in the playground, who a few years later would be at Point Loma with a man FCA paid to have there, saying, come down to the front if men have let you down, and I'll introduce you to someone who will never let you down. And I can only testify to this one thing. God has never, ever let me down. And I want to say thank you, FCA, for showing me the way. God bless you guys.